ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me is my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
Howdy, hey.
How's it going, my friend?
Oh, so well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You sound a little lackluster in the excitement department there,
hey,
man.
Hey, I am so excited. You know, I'm actually very reserved. I'm contemplative, I'm chill, because the movie that we're going to review today kind of makes you all those things.
It gives you all the feels and gives you the roller coaster of emotions. Well, you know what? Like Chad said, we got a great movie in store to review tonight, and you know what? We can't wait to let you hear it. So, yeah, The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded without any harmful effects on the global climate at VGB Studios in Sacramento, California.
That's what the scientists tell us.
If this is your first time listening to the podcast, you may like to know that you can subscribe to The Filmlosophers and download previous episodes on your favorite platforms, including iTunes, Audioboom, Google Play, Player FM, Stitcher, or Libsyn. Filmlosophers are also welcome to connect with us on social media. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Then share your thoughts about our latest episodes and other recent movie news. You can also check out all of our episodes and other great podcasts on our website at vgbstudios.com. There you can find Video Game Bang as well as me, Mike, Self, and I. And
us.
And us. Obviously.
Because philosophers,
exactly.
Course.
If you're here to listen to us, and we know we've kind of steered you in the right direction.
I'm here to listen to us.
Yeah, that's actually true. Now that I think about it, we're here to listen to each other, so we're glad that you are here to join us as well.
That's right.
But we have a great show in store, and like I said, you know what? We're going to have some really good conversations later on. But you know what? Before we get to any of that, we just got to say, you know what? We're a little excited to see how the future goes in terms of... We're not going to get political on anybody, just in case anybody's wondering. We're not going to go all out. We are here to report the movie news and all things that are happening in Hollywood. So just to let you know, that's kind of where we're going to stay at. That's our niche, to talk about movies.
Oh, for sure.
So if you want to talk about politics and whatnot, I'm pretty sure there's plenty of other podcasts.
There are places you can do that.
Exactly, but
this
not
place
here.
This is not that place.
This is not that place. So yeah, at the top of movie news tonight, we're going to do a movie trailer rundown real quick. So obviously within this last week, it's been a very interesting week of news, you know, with the election and all different sorts of things happening.
Very interesting.
So
roller coaster ride, some ups, some downs, some crazy turns and loop-de-loops.
It's true. And we're not just talking about movies. But like I said, we are a movie podcast, so let's talk about those things, specifically movie trailers. So in the last week or so, there's been a plethora of different trailers that have been released.
There's only one that matters. You know it.
You're talking about Beauty and the Beast?
Yeah, everybody cares about it. Everybody cares about it so much.
So Beauty and the Beast, the full-length trailer, was released today. And if you're not sure about what that's about, if you've been living under a rock, Disney's full-length trailer for their live-action film starring Emma Watson as Belle, also Dan Stevens as the Beast, Luke Evans as Gaston, Ewan McGregor as Lumiere, Ian McKellen as Cogsworth, Emma Thompson as Mrs. Potts, so many other people. So this is Disney's attempt at making a live-action film. We kind of hit a little bit on this when we were talking about Mulan and we were talking about Lion King. So they finally released a full trailer for Beauty and the Beast. Chad, what are your thoughts initially for that?
You know, it's interesting. I grew up in the animation renaissance of Disney. Obviously, Disney started leading the pack early on in terms of animated, full-length animated features with the musical numbers and all of that happening. And then it, you know, kind of faded for a few years. And then right in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this flare-up again. Beauty and the Beast was arguably the most famous, or the most well-received critically, for sure, of that set of films. And now you've got the live-action trailer, I was struck by how almost, not shot for shot, but this film is clearly sticking true to the visual motifs and the mise-en-scene of the animated original, whereas mm-hmm. some of the other films that they've done, The Jungle Book being the most recent one that I can think of from Disney,
yeah.
also Cinderella year and a half, 2 years ago, they weren't as necessarily scene-by-scene faithful
yeah.
to the animated version because they were telling a live-action, somewhat different, maybe deeper story. I think Beauty and the Beast is one of those films that was so well-received as an animated film that you don't dare change too much about it. And I think that this trailer kind of proved that because you had a lot of very familiar sequences kind of translated into live action. I thought it was a very solid first outing in terms of showing people what the whole film feels like. How about you?
You know, you hit on a very specific point. One of the biggest things when it comes to films is its ability to take an inspired work, a work, you know, of creativity, and create something that isn't exactly like frame for frame that. Now, mind you, you have masterpieces like the animated version of Beauty and the Beast. You have all these different types of things. Like Jungle Book was an interesting one to kind of pick off of because the original Jungle Book, there wasn't really much content to that. It was a lot of like song and dance or whatnot. But you take films like Cinderella. You take films like Beauty and the Beast. Lion King is another one that they're going to be doing.
Oh, Lion King is another one I would do almost shot for shot.
This is one of those ones where I like the idea of it being shot for shot because, the like I said, the first film was a masterpiece. I just don't like the way everything looks. Like, I'm not too sold on like how Lumiere looks. I'm not too sold on how Cogsworth looks. How they're making it to where the cartoony vibe that worked so well with the first Beauty and the Beast, with the way everything looked, the personification of like all these different things, allowing them to feel like they're, you know, real and they have humanistic feelings because of the shape of the nose, or the way the handle looks like a nose, or the way the face of the clock looks like a face. And they're going with a more realistic approach for, you know, things in the house and the servants of sorts. So I'm not too sure how well that's going to be received by a lot of other people. In fact, I'm probably thinking that it may actually scare some of the kids as opposed to give that sense of awe and wonder. Because then you're going to have children that are going to go home and see grandma's clock that's on the mantle and worry that
imagine
it's
going to... Imagine it coming to life.
Exactly. Whereas like if you saw when people saw the animated version, it wasn't as scary because there was a sense of like almost jolliness, like jovial, you know, features on each particular piece of cutlery or whatever.
I mean,
it is.
They were very cartoony looking.
It was.
This does not have a cartoonish appearance, any of the enchanted objects.
Not by far. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I wasn't too impressed. I liked the idea of it telling fans this is going to be a practically shot-for-shot version of the cartoon.
As far as we can tell so far, yeah.
And by what we've seen so far, it seems to really emulate that a lot. I mean, you have the whole kill the beast and, you know, whatever with Gaston, who I think is probably the most accurate-looking character so far in that trailer. Luke Evans as Gaston.
No, I think that Belle looked pretty much, you know, spot on. She's, again, it's the non-enchanted.
Yeah.
Characters, if you will, are probably going to appear the most true to the animated feature because they have, to your point, they have changed the character design of all of the enchanted creatures.
Yeah. Another film that was released earlier this week was Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Based on the graphic novel series, the movie stars Dane DeHaan as Valerian and Cara Delevingne as Loreline, special operatives for the government of the human territories charged with maintaining order throughout the universe. That is a lot.
Yeah, and to clarify, the movie wasn't released. The trailer was released this past week.
The trailer, yes.
Another movie that was released.
Sorry.
Yeah, this one was an interesting one. This is Luc Besson, who, in a way, for me, he gained mainstream popularity with The Fifth Element and then mm-hmm. had a series of other properties since then. But yeah, this is one of those very where Beauty and the Beast takes the original cartoonish elements and tries to make them more realistic, this movie is more on the cartoonish side to me. It has a lot of bright colors, a lot of interesting cartoonish-looking characters, and what appears to be a very complicated world. Maybe not a complicated story, but a complicated space to tell a story in.
Yeah, it's based off of a graphic novel series, a French graphic novel series that I'm not all too familiar with, but in what I've seen so far, it's supposed to be a tale, the series is supposed to be a tale of those two particular individuals in the film, and that kind of stems on several different adventures throughout the course of the series. And I don't know, though, I like the idea of it seeming like it'd be in the same universe as The Fifth Element. It looks pretty spot on.
A lot of them do, yeah.
I'm pretty sure if he had the abilities that he has now with CGI and computer animation and whatnot, he would probably put a lot of the things that he had in this film that we see in The Fifth Element. Like,
undoubtedly, yeah.
So for me, I think I find comfort in seeing the familiarity, because we liked The Fifth Element. Yeah, it was a good film.
Very unique story, unique film, but it's good because of it.
Yeah, this is a very unique property that unfortunately I'm not all too familiar with, and to give, like, it's going to be one of those ones where the more and more we find more about it, the more we can actually kind of have some solid ground to say, oh, okay, this is going to be cool, or oh, it's not. Because let's face it, the trailer that was released gave us nothing. I mean, other than great visuals and great, you know, cinematography of the sci-fi landscape, so to speak, there's not much else to the storyline that it really gave that kind of allowed us to see, oh, okay, this is what it's about.
Well, and here's the thing that I found actually quite unfortunate about the trailer. The Fifth Element had Gary Oldman, amazing. I mean, like, campy as all get out in that film, but amazing in that film. Bruce Willis doing his thing, Sir Ian Holm, and that opera lady with the balloon head. Yeah. This film has Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne as the title characters, and they get a lot of FaceTime in this trailer, and I was not feeling them at all. Mm. I thought they looked extremely uncomfortable in their costumes.
Yeah.
A lot of the pseudo action sequences that they kind of sort of started showing were like, okay, they're very colorful and you know it's a fake environment, but they were obviously green screen, obviously wire work. Like, there seemed to be a lack of fluidity, I guess, a lack of natural movement and emotion and expression and drive. I don't know this property. Maybe both characters are cyborgs or full-on AI, you know, entities, and that would explain it.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything for me that was compelling me, drawing me into their world or their experience. I don't feel like they're characters that I'm likely to connect with, and therefore it's a movie that's kind of already moving toward the, I'll pass.
Yeah.
On that one.
And just like how The Fifth Element had a lot of interesting names, I mean, some of the names that are tied to this film are like Ethan Hawke. Obviously, you see Rihanna in the trailer.
Briefly.
Clive Owen is in it. John Goodman plays, or he voices one of the characters.
Most of them are probably voice actors, given what we saw.
Yeah. Rutger Hauer is in it. So it does have a very eclectic and unique roster of individuals, because I don't remember any movie where I've seen Ethan Hawke, Rihanna, and Clive Owen all on one stage. But hey,
won't see them all in this one either.
You'll hear
a couple of them and you'll see Rihanna. I don't know how many of these are actually live action roles.
And IMDb doesn't really, all it says for John Goodman is voice. So, yeah. I mean, that could be anything.
So many of them, I mean, they could actually be cameos. You know, The Fifth Element had Bruce Willis as its, like, main character. He was already a likable performer before making the movie. He did his job perfectly in the movie, and he was surrounded by some, you know, colorful situations and characters throughout.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even mention Ruby Rod.
Chris Tucker.
Yes, Chris Tucker. Thank you. Breakout role for him.
Yeah.
Very odd, very unique, very funny. But, I don't know. Like, I just... I don't see stars leading a very expensive film. I see characters being very, I don't know. I don't generally have anything against either of the two main performers. I just, in this particular set of scenes, I there was nothing that really struck me as, oh, that looks really compelling and interesting.
Yeah.
And I feel like you're an interesting character. I kind of was bored.
And I think one of the biggest things to kind of take away from this is that you know that Cara Delevingne is coming off of Suicide Squad. So she's had her moment in the sun, and maybe that's kind of what drew the studios to kind of pick her for this. And you also have Dane DeHaan.
You mean her shimmy?
Her shimmy.
Her shimmy in the subway.
Her sorceress shimmy. And then Dane DeHaan has his, that How to Get Well or something really weird kind of.
Oh, right. The Art of Wellness or the.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that.
So I'm
the trailer that tells you nothing about the movie.
It tells you nothing else other than the fact that this looks like a huge French art film or something. That's all I gathered from it. So I guess like as we get more and more revealed about the story, we'll be able to kind of get a bigger picture. Another trailer that was dropped this week was Solace. So we see Anthony Hopkins return to the big screen. We haven't seen him do really anything lately. But he returns and he's co-starring alongside Colin Farrell. One plays a psychic, the other a meticulous serial killer who battle mind to mind. This is a really interesting film because Anthony Hopkins, who usually plays the straight man, like the straight edge person individual, is playing a psychic to aid the FBI in capturing Colin Farrell, who is this serial killer. And then Anthony Hopkins' character finds out that Colin Farrell is actually a psychic himself and is playing mind games.
He's a better psychic than the psychic.
Yeah, exactly. I think this film may just be right over that line of just too much going on in a film. You have what could possibly be a good premise if it was a little bit more toned down, like if Colin Farrell was more of like a mentalist rather than a psychic. If he was somebody who knew how to kind of
read people
really well.
Yeah.
But then you got it's turning into, what was that film with Robert De Niro and Clive, the guy who played Scarecrow? I forget his name, but
I know I can picture him.
They did a film together about Robert De Niro being this incredibly weird magician who may actually be real, and he claims to be real. And the Scarecrow guy, he partners with Sigourney Weaver as debunkers, and they're like out to try to debunk Robert De Niro because Robert De Niro is technically blind. And so he's able to do all this stuff, whatever. And they're able to...
Here's my thing with this movie. I didn't know anything about it before watching the trailer last week. And at first you're watching it, you're like, oh, Sir Anthony Hopkins. I always love watching him. He's pretty much always compelling, even if he has a small part. Because there are no small parts, only small players.
Exactly.
The thing that struck me about this, though, I was watching the trailer and I thought... I couldn't help but think, you know, sometimes movie studios have performers on contract to do a certain number of pictures in a defined amount of time. Like, for example, if I'm signed on to do, you know, some period romance, and it's going to be an Oscar-worthy film, and the studio thinks that as a performer, they might be able to get more mileage out of me than just this one award contender film, then they might contract me for 3 to 5 films in a 10-year period of time. And it's up to me and my team to coordinate schedules appropriately to make sure that all those projects are good projects. To me, this one felt like there are quite a few names in this film, but there wasn't anything in the trailer that to me really said, wow, this is really not a film that's just, you know, moving through the paces. Honestly, a lot of the trailer made it feel like this film is pretty much just moving through the paces, which to me says all these actors are on contract with whoever it is that's put this film together, and their contracts are expiring, so they decided to put them all in one movie together and hope that it works.
Yeah.
That may be completely off base. That's just the way that it felt to me.
Oh, no, and it definitely feels like that, because it's like, all right, we got these guys, let's just throw them in something real quick so we can get some type of revenue off of them. Because not only is it Anthony Hopkins and Colin Farrell, but you also got names like Jeffrey Dean Morgan, Matt Gerrard, Jose Pablo Cantillo. You got names that are like, they're known for unique pieces here and there. Jose Pablo Cantillo was on Walking Dead. Jeffrey Dean Morgan has done everything.
He's now on Walking
and
Dead.
And he's now on Walking Dead. Anthony Hopkins is, you know, legend in his own right.
Colin soon be on Walking Dead.
Yeah, we'll soon be on. Well, no, technically, he's doing his own Westworld.
He's in Westworld.
And yeah. Then Colin Farrell is partying somewhere. But the thing is that this film feels like it's like, everything is like, let's take some of the greatest ideas we can, mash them together, let's throw a little sci-fi into the mix, make everybody who's important psychic, and then, like, at the end of the film, I'm pretty sure Jeffrey Dean Morgan is going to find out he's psychic, too, and that's how they're able to defeat
Colin
Farrell.
You know, the thing that I hope for is that it has the same effect as the first Now You See Me had on me, because I had the same feeling with Now You See Me. I thought, oh, all these people are on contract. They just threw them in a movie together. It doesn't look all that inventive. I went to see it in the theater, and I actually really enjoyed it. The second one was a bit of a rehash, and I wasn't as fond of that. I remember I was sitting next
to you when we saw it.
but the first one really,
yeah,
surprised me in a good way. I'm hoping that this film will do the same thing, because I do like several of the performers. It just, from the trailer, it feels like they're just kind of going through the motions.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's all we really can say about that. But the final trailer that actually dropped, I believe, Tuesday, which is getting a lot of attention.
Was it over the weekend?
Was it over the weekend?
Yeah, we saw it over the weekend, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Is the full-length trailer for Ghost in the Shell, starring Scarlett Johansson as the Major in the live-action film based on the Japanese anime film from 1995.
Which I have not seen. Have you seen it?
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting film. It's about the premise of, so the Major is a shell. So essentially the body form.
I mean, she's essentially, from the trailer, it seems like she's an AI who's wanting to not be controlled by whoever built her anymore, right?
But it's more than just Scarlett Johansson. It's the idea, the actual thought, I guess, the mind of the Major. Every time she goes, so they send her out to go do battle. She's part of an organization called Section 9, and Section 9 will deploy her when they need her to take something out or do something militaristic. In the event that she gets damaged, she actually discards her outward body, which it's a machine, and they create a whole new one, which looks similar as her one previous.
Sure.
And her AI gets uploaded back into the new shell. So ergo the idea of Ghost in the Shell.
Right.
And the story goes is that she ends up in the film. I don't know how well the movie, this one, is going to go and follow that, but in the...
Probably pretty faithfully. It's got a good following.
Well, in the anime film, she meets up with someone else. She finds someone else who has a similar build structure. He works with another organization. They meet.
It's a boy robot?
It is a boy robot.
A girl robot and a boy robot meet. And so is it a love story?
No.
I knew.
It's about the understanding of what freedom is and being able to obtain it, even though you are tied to an organization through being like a prisoner in the shells, so to speak.
Sure.
So it's a really great film. The anime was really touching. It hit on a lot of philosophical topics throughout the course of it as far as dying.
Do you think the live action will be?
I believe it will. I honestly do, because of the fact that they're trying to do so much with this film. They're trying to make it so recognizable for most fans, despite the casting of Scarlett Johansson in the character role that it is, which that's a whole ordeal all on its own. I think that they're going to have it very familiar with fans. They're going to create it to be something that when the fans see it, they're like, oh yeah, I remember that part. Or I remember Bateau and him saying this to her. Or I remember this scene when they're talking here, or when this and they do this, you know. I'm interested.
Thank you for not spoiling the plot.
Yeah. Well, there's
this
a lot
and
of
that and,
there's
or a, when they did this and that.
There's a lot of names or a lot of things. But it's the anime.
Visually, it seems faithful to the anime.
Oh yeah, the anime was visually stunning. It was very well done, even for it being made back in 1995. It was a very beautiful film. You see the trailer, and you can see the amount of time and effort that they put into it. But
yeah, they obviously have invested in this film, in doing justice to what people loved about the original.
Yeah. So it's only a matter of time as to when they'll actually start addressing the elephant in the room, I guess, as far as casting choices, and actually speak to some of the people who are really strongly opposed to the whole idea of them casting Scarlett Johansson. And mind you, that's for a whole nother show. We can get into that later. But all in all, yeah, based on
suffice it to say, people are concerned.
Oh yeah, of course. People are, you know, ever since the whole Matt Damon thing, the Great Wall of China, and just about every role, even with we were talking about last week with Doctor Strange, or the week before that, we were talking about Doctor Strange and the role of the Ancient One. There's always going to be that, and I feel like that in its own right has a whole amount of time to talk about. I mean, we can go on and on about it. But I think just based off the trailer looks very beautiful. The shell process that they released, the clip that shows how Scarlett Johansson is created and put into the shell, I think is very accurate to the film. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of time before we see more footage and kind of gauge how much are they willing to invest in making this as familiar to the original anime film as they can.
Interestingly enough, the original anime does not have a sequel, correct?
No.
So, I mean, it could be interesting to see if they try to create a franchise out of the live-action version, or if this is just one and done.
That would be interesting, yeah.
Again, knowing literally zero about the story, aside from what I could glean from this particular live-action trailer from over the weekend.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's even sequelable.
That's true. But that does segue us into our special presentation of our review today of the sci-fi film. I'm waiting to see if Chad's gonna jump yet.
I was surprised. the extravaganza, the
sci-fi hit film that's been released over this weekend and is getting critically acclaimed all over the world. Arrival. Now, we went to go see this film last week, and unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to get into the studio and talk about it as soon as we could, but we did know that we were going to, because it was such a beautifully well-done film.
Yeah, this is not... I told people going into the weekend, we did get to see a preview showing a couple days before it released in the theaters, and then actually went back and saw it again to kind of compare notes. The way the story plays out kind of lends itself to multiple viewings, just to, you know, check off a few boxes, if you will.
Yeah.
And what I would tell people after seeing it, you know, a couple days before it came out, was it's not the movie that you expected it to be when you went into the theater.
Yeah.
And to its benefit, to its credit, I think that's a good thing, that it was actually a much better movie. I already expected to like it, you know, with the expectations that I had going in. It turned out to be, in my opinion, a far better film and experience overall than what I was anticipating it to be.
Yeah. When 12 mysterious spacecrafts touch down across the globe, an elite team led by expert linguist Louise Banks is brought together to investigate. As mankind teeters on the verge of global war, Banks and the team race against time for answers. To find them, she will take a chance that could threaten her life and quite possibly humanity. So Arrival is directed by the incredibly talented Denis Villeneuve, the brains behind films such as 2013's Prisoners and Enemy, as well as the outstanding 2015 action crime drama Sicario. The film stars Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, and Forest Whitaker. We were talking about this off the air, how you can see Denis Villeneuve's kind of thought process when he does films, when he creates a film, especially from works like Sicario. Sicario is a very it's a very interesting ride that you take that usually leads to a point of epiphany, so to speak, at the end of the film, and the epiphany is a great payoff. I have yet to find a film that he's done that doesn't pay off as, you know, greatly as any other film.
Yeah, he definitely likes to fully occupy a certain zone. Whatever the story is that he and his crew are working on in any particular film, it's kind of the difference between I want to say skimming through a book versus reading a book in detail.
Yeah.
And I think that his style of directing and storytelling is definitely the latter. He gets into a groove and he really, really settles into it and delivers a complete experience of, you know, whatever that wavelength is for that story.
Yeah, the film was based on a short story written by Ted Chiang in 1998 titled Story of Your Life. Though there are quite a few similarities between the two tales, they take a unique turn away from each other to come to their respective resolutions. I was actually able to read the short story, and I did write an article based on the differences. And there are minuscule differences, but it does really kind of, you know, turn and go in the opposite direction when the film does get towards its latter parts, which we'll talk about later. And just a heads up to anybody listening to this, if you haven't seen the film, spoiler alert, we will be talking about the ending and kind of getting into that.
Yeah, we won't go too far into detail on every single thing within the film that might be spoilery. But, you know, in order to do justice to the story and the craft, we do have to spoil a few things.
Yeah, we have to hit on a couple things. I actually enjoyed the short story. I read it after we saw the film. I was able to read it, and the film is a little bit more logical, I guess. It requires a little bit more of like understanding of terms with, you know, linguists and mathematicians. But it overall is very much in the same vein as each other as the film, obviously, because they're both from the same source material. But like I said, in that ending in the last act, it does, you know, kind of turn in different directions. The film has become a kind of point of discussion for most movie critics, as the reactions to the film vary from loved it to hated it. Arrival debuted at the Venice Film Festival, where it won the Future Film Festival Digital Award and also had screenings at Telluride and the BFI London Film Festival. So, Chad, briefly, what were your initial reactions after the film?
Initial reactions after the first time seeing the film, masterpiece. I was floored by the craftsmanship of the film. Are there moments that if I had my druthers, would I change them a bit? Sure, absolutely. I usually have a few things that I would love to change, but I think in the probably in the final 10 minutes or so of the film, the first time seeing it, I was literally sitting in the audience thinking, this is one of the most well-made films I have ever seen or probably will ever see. And it felt actually to me as a film buff, as a bit of a connoisseur, it felt like a very special moment to me sitting there. It felt like almost the feeling that you get when somebody surprises you with a gift. You weren't expecting, you know, a gift, a present, and somebody just shows up and gives you something that has, you know, a lot of meaning for you. And it was a surprise and it was great. And I think that's definitely the zone that I was sitting in as the credits were rolling at the end of the film. How about you?
Same here. I really was impressed by the film. I did come into it a little worried at first because of the fact that I did hear the varied reactions by most critics, and I was thinking, I'm like, oh man, I hope this film wasn't just all hype and it didn't deliver, you know. And after, you know, those credits roll and you know, you see at the very end of the film it'll impose the title of the film, Arrival, right across the screen, and then it rolls to the credits. It's like, man, I just you ultimately feel like you've witnessed history. You know, I know this is kind of an above the, you know, over the top type of saying, but when you see the film and you experience it for the very first time, you are just witnessing ultimately the birth of like a brand new genre. Because even though this film falls into the line of sci-fi and so forth, this kind of surpassed even what most expectations are for sci-fi films. I thought it was well done. I thought it was probably my new favorite cerebral type sci-fi. I was a huge fan of Contact for the longest, and this is the point of comparison that I tell most people, is that the film is more Contact than it is Independence Day, because it's more
easily,
about,
yeah.
But even then, and you actually had mentioned this when we came out of the theaters, you're like, oh yeah, that's true, but it surpasses Contact miles ahead.
For me, it's way beyond that. And really, it's something beyond there. You will be, if you haven't seen the film already, more than likely when you go and view it, you will be tempted to treat it as a thinking film, mm-hmm. because there is a lot of thinking you need to do. Like there's the language gap between these alien visitors and Amy Adams's character and the team that she's a part of, and they're trying to bridge that gap in a very strategic, intelligent, thinking kind of way. Yeah. And so as a viewer, you're going to sit there and you're going to try to quote unquote figure it out. You're going to try to figure out how it's all going to come together or whatever. You're going to be tempted to do that. I would urge you, though, don't get so stuck in your brain that you don't engage your other senses, because between the sound editing, especially in the beginning of the film,
mm-hmm.
The cinematography, this Bradford Young or whatever his name is, who did Selma and some other work with Ava DuVernay, he needs an Oscar stat. This thing was visually one of the most gorgeous films. It's a subtle beauty,
mm-hmm.
throughout the entire thing, from the lack of intense makeup. I mean, it's all like human faces, not decorated faces. The darker tones with some pops of color, the limiting the viewpoint of the viewer, like limiting the camera to see only a certain part of a larger scene in many instances throughout the film. It kind of builds this anticipation and this yearning, and then when you get to the end of the film, the payoff in many ways is actually an emotional payoff, not an intellectual payoff.
Mm-hmm.
There definitely is an intellectual payoff and a component to it, but it is profoundly, I would say, emotional by the end of it. Of course, the swelling violin music that they've embedded in the beginning and the end of the film helps a lot with how you're supposed to feel,
mm-hmm.
And just the kind of the good angst. It's not the like teenage angst. It's the cathartic kind of angst. It's the good. It's all the feels, but in a good way. It's the way that the best types of performances really draw something out of you that you weren't expecting, you know, to feel, let alone express. Maybe, I mean, there were definitely people crying in both showings that we've been to.
Yeah,
my eyes welled up at one point. I'm not afraid to say it was a very emotionally impactful film. I wasn't expecting that to be the case.
Yeah. So when you start the film, when you begin to watch the film, you're introduced to some key characters. But even before you're introduced to the actual story of the film, you're introduced to kind of the foundation, I guess, if you will, of what this story is built upon, which is, and as we said, there are spoilers, but in order to really discuss the movie in the amount of respect that we can, we do have to divulge certain things. And in the opening sequence, you are made aware that Amy Adams' daughter has passed, that Amy Adams had a daughter, and she raised her up until somewhere in her late teens, because she does look fairly old enough to be in the upper teens, but not old enough to be, I guess, over 20. She looks still rather...
Yeah, late high school, early college.
Yeah.
Age by the time that she passes. And it's like the beginning sequence of,
yes,
Up. You see this entire relationship and story in a very short amount of time, and it has an extremely poignant, unexpectedly sad resolution within the first probably 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
And you're sort of sitting there thinking, oh, this is like up So
yeah.
Hopefully it has a house with lots of balloons that flies in the air, which it doesn't.
No.
You know, but still, very meaningful. It already has kind of a complete opening story before you get into the story that you were expecting to be in, which was, you know, a story about aliens coming and us trying to figure out how to talk to them.
Yeah, and this is where you're introduced to the character that Amy Adams portrays, which is Dr. Louise Banks. And one of the unique things about Amy Adams, I do have to say, I'm not a huge fan of her work. I haven't really liked her portrayal as Lois Lane in the Man of Steel, Superman portions that she plays, as well as I wasn't a fan of her role in Fighter, where she plays a Boston chick that Mark Wahlberg is with. I'm just not a fan of hers. But this film, though, I would say that she's probably going to be one of those contenders for a, you know, best actress role in a film. She does a phenomenal job. Even in that opening sequence, there's a lot more heart that I've seen in those first 5 minutes from her and being genuine than I've seen her do in pretty much any other role that she's been a part of. For me personally,
I think so. I mean, you definitely ultimately, a lot of the thematically, this is a story about humanity and how we are toward one another and how we should be toward one another, more so than how would we react if aliens came and tried to talk to us, or we, you know, in the beginning we wouldn't know what they were trying to do. Much of the film is really about the human journey and whether or not we know how to talk to each other. And as many cases in our outside of the movie theater real lives can probably indicate, in many ways, oftentimes we don't know how to communicate very well with each other. Mm-hmm. And that actually is one of the key thematic points of the film overall, is that idea of communicating, you know, one to the other as human beings. I think the genius of her performance in this movie in particular, I agree with you, there are times in other films where it feels like this is Amy Adams acting.
Yeah.
Rather than just this is a human being, you know, with a certain name in this story. Sometimes I feel her acting, and many performers do that with me. Like, you can feel them acting. There's something about the performance that doesn't quite draw you in. I think this role, even though it is more understated in many ways than several of her other roles, it feels the most genuine.
Yeah.
It's one of those, the whole movie really is, but specifically her performance is, it's meant to draw you close. It's meant to pull you into her space and just kind of sit there in the confusion, in the fear, in the uncertainty, in the hopefulness, you know, ultimately. And in order to really occupy that space with her character, Amy Adams as a performer has to kind of present an open enough doorway for you to fit there, you know, with her. And I think that she does a marvelous job in this movie, primarily for the understated parts.
Yeah. And of course you have Forest Whitaker, which is always, he's always a great actor. You have Jeremy Renner, who I think personally takes a back seat to Amy Adams' character, and he does a great job as a supporting role. I don't think he's much of a lead character in this film. So honestly,
no, this is totally her film.
Yeah, this is 100% her film.
Similar to Sandra Bullock with Gravity.
Yes.
Although that was all about adrenaline, and this is all about something much less angsty than adrenaline. But you know, so Sandra Bullock had, you know, George Clooney had a featured role in that film, but wasn't there the entire time, and it wasn't really about him. Similar here with Jeremy Renner's character, although it's a little bit more about him than Gravity would involve George Clooney. But
yeah,
don't want to give too much away.
No, not yet. So as most people know from the trailers, these ships come to Earth and they surprise the heck out of the world. Everyone is amazed and astonished, and the governments are all wondering what's going on. So, The military sends Colonel Weber, who is played by Forest Whitaker, to go and find the linguist expert, Dr. Louise Banks, to try to persuade her in trying to figure out what the aliens are saying. They want to communicate with these guys. And through some kind of funny banter and negotiating, she ends up kind of...
She's their expert.
Yeah, she ends up becoming their expert. And so the film takes off from there as far as going to the site and meeting the alien, so to speak. And it's pretty much a race on the clock to try to figure out what's going on before anybody loses their cool and tries to do something stupid. I think the way this film moves, and we've talked about this, in our own time, this film moves a little slow. The story is a very paceful. It does take its time in terms of delivering the pieces of kind of nuggets that it does deliver. And in the idea of most people who go see the film, that can be a big turnoff. My wife included, we went to go see it on Sunday, and after the film, we were all talking, and of course, me and Chad were already sold on the film. But my wife was like, "I don't know, that was a little slow for me." And my wife has very particular taste when it comes to films, and this one may have been a little bit kind of underwhelming for her, because just she likes action and craziness and explosions and all that kind of, you know.
Yeah, I would caution against saying most people will feel like that, though. It does have an 83% audience positive score on Rotten Tomatoes. So I think that there are some people that it won't be a good fit for.
Yeah.
Critically, also, it's 93% fresh. You've got 207 positive reviews and only 16 negative reviews. So when we say that there's a love it or hate it experience, that is actually true. There aren't a lot of middle of the road experiences, but there do happen to currently be more love it than hate it.
Oh yeah.
The majority is in favor of what's going on, but it definitely is. It's a very deliberate film. Every decision, every moment is extremely purposeful. And some of that purpose is, I think, in many ways to slow us down to pay attention to the story that we're seeing, feeling, experiencing, yeah. You know, whatever. And if it was, it could stand to be probably a little faster paced, but if it was kind of, you know, cut, you know, these fast paced films that we've become so accustomed to, we would completely miss the point by the end of the film.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have the payoff that it has. So I think that part of the challenge that, that the crew faced was, How do we get people from A to Z? How do we do that without, number one, boring them so completely that they don't make it to Z because they fall asleep and they're, you know, there are multiple Zs, you know, floating above their head while they sleep. And then two, we don't want to rush them through so that they miss the end point when they get there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And based off of the people that we went to the movies with and the crowd that was there the second time around, there were a few folks who were like, "Oh, I didn't get it. It was horrible." And mind you, those seem like more the people who would rather go see like a Mission Impossible remake.
Fine.
And that's, you know, that's, I mean, more their, you know.
In a way, that's kind of the precedent set for potential alien invasion films.
Yes, yeah, true.
That there's going to be something explosive or sinister or, you know, something.
Yeah, but I think this is the formula that Denis Villeneuve has taken upon himself to really harness and kind of cultivate within his films, because most of his films seem to mirror the same type of formula as far as the pacing and the patience in storytelling. Because when you go into a film, not many people do have this mindset, but tentatively I share this mindset with you, and you kind of have it in the same mind, that when you go, you're going with the idea and the mentality that you're trusting this director, that he's going to pay off at the end of the film. That's what you go in. It's almost like a negotiation. You know, you're hoping that this director pulled his weight and really did his work, and when we're going to, you know, I'm paying this money to go see the film, so it needs to pay off. I think the thing with Denis Villeneuve and the way his formula works, I have no doubt in my mind that he will pay off every time. Now, because of the fact that he's showed up with Sicario, with Enemy, with I haven't fully Prisoners. Seen Prisoners, mm-hmm. but with Prisoners, Sicario, and now with this one, one of my favorite films, and I've said several times over the last couple of episodes that one of my favorite films is Blade Runner. And now that I know that this man is on the docket list to direct it and make it, make the sequel to it, at first I was a little worried, but now seeing as how well he does and how well his formula pays off in the end, I now have no doubt in my mind that he's going to create a work of art.
Well, the beautiful thing about his approach seems to be, it's almost like in literature you might talk about something like a tone poem, right? A tone poem is not necessarily always about the narrative. It's about the feeling. It's about setting a mood and really working that mood, you know, to its most effective resolution. And he's done this with Prisoners, with Enemy, with Sicario. I've seen and enjoyed all of those, and they're very different than this film. This film is very different from them. Blade Runner will be different still. It does not have the same tone, and I think that's brilliant. He's not a one-trick pony, so he can take, you know, kind of whatever story, I think. He can take whatever story, and once he decides what the tonal elements of the story are going to be and how to get there, you do, in many ways, I think, have a masterpiece on your hands. Are there things that could go better? Yes, absolutely, always. All the greats would probably argue the same thing for their films. So it'll be interesting to see what he does with the Blade Runner sequel. I believe it's a sequel, not
a
reboot.
A
so it'll be interesting to see what he does with that from a tonal perspective, because he's as I said before, he's really good at settling into a groove.
Yeah.
And getting you there. Another thing I would point out for those more art house film goers that might be listening is a filmmaker that has a lot of similarity is Terrence Malick. He's done a lot, especially recently, that are essentially film versions of tone poems in many ways, with Knight of Cups was the most recent one.
Yeah.
No, well,
Tree of Life was another one that he
Yeah, Tree of Life was the first one. The middle one was
The Fountain?
That was Aronofsky. The middle one was the one with Ben Affleck and Olga Kurylenko and Rachel McAdams, To the Wonder. And you've got a lot of, you know, extreme close-ups and big sunburst blowouts and all kinds of clever visual tricks to show beauty or deprivation. I think that one of the things I enjoyed about Arrival from Denis Villeneuve was in many ways for me, he kind of out Terrence Malick. He didn't use the entire film in that way, but he used the most impactful and important parts in that way, and it felt a lot more genuine than when you spend almost an entire feature-length film doing that in some of those more recent Malick films.
And no great film is ever without its score. You know, great films are always built upon the music in the background, and you can really see the director's vision for most scenes when it's paired well with the music that's in it. And this is no exception. The composer for this film, which was Johan Johansson, I believe his name is.
Probably Johan.
Johan.
Yeah, I mean.
Johan.
You get it.
He does, of course, we've heard his work in Sicario, which really is a great film that shows the buildup of scenes, and it works well with how the scene is composed. In this one, there's no doubt in my mind that he did an incredible job. I mean, every single scene that he is, you know, his work is evident in, is just phenomenal, and it marries well with the tone and the pace of the film, to where it's not it doesn't allow for rushing when there doesn't need to be rushing. It just sets in, and it allows for the environment to be filled with a sound rather than,
yeah, it's almost like a blend of a soundtrack and sound effects.
Yes,
in many ways the way that he composes kind of blends those two sides of the audio spectrum.
He does. So I think that's, but you did find a unique thing. You found, because the opening of the film is a very unique,
beautiful, beautiful, gorgeous piece of music.
But it's not by Johann.
No. The film opens and closes. It similar to, you've probably, if you've seen the trailer at all, you've probably seen what the written language of these alien beings looks like. It's a circle, and it has different characteristics, and that's the way that they communicate ideas in a written format. And similar to the circular structure of their language, this film has a very circular structure in that the end and the beginning tie together seamlessly. They very much close a loop by the end of the film, and in order to do that, they do that both visually and with the voiceover narration, mm-hmm. of Amy Adams's character, and then also with this beautiful piece of orchestral music called "On the Nature of Daylight" by Max Richter. It's previously been in several other films, including Shutter Island, interestingly enough, and it is just gorgeous. It's already, when the film opens and you start hearing this music as Amy Adams, her character is kind of in voiceover talking to her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You're already noticing how I don't know. It's mournful and it's beautiful. It's something in between,
yeah,
good and bad. It's just a very full, complete kind of feeling. And then when it comes back in the end of the film, and they're going for the real, you know, gut punch to the emotions,
yeah,
like, we will make you cry, by golly.
Man, when the music comes forceful back,
I mean, it's gorgeous. It's
yeah,
quite a piece of music.
Yeah, and kind of adding to that, as far as that piece that's added on the end, this film is very much so, much like their form of language that the aliens speak to the humans, they utilize this form of sentence structure called a logogram, which is simply a sentence done in a circle. So there's no beginning or end, and it's all done in one beautifully pieced out work of art. And that's how they...
Which reportedly, the screenwriter actually sketched a lot of these bits to pitch the film to executives.
Between Denis Villeneuve and the screenplay writer, Eric Hessner, I believe his name is, they actually created the entire language that they utilize in the film. So that I thought was pretty cool.
So cool.
So you see this, and the idea that they're trying to convey, and the idea that the film is trying to convey, is that everything's circular, that everything has a purpose, and that things come full circle, and that there's a sense of congruity, I guess you could say, in life itself, how things are meant to, you know, happen in different places, but they all serve the same purpose, and that's kind of mirrored not only by the language, but even with the music. Like you said, that piece that's done at the beginning is also done at the end, kind of showing how, much like the language, it all comes full circle. It's all one large circle of life, I guess you could say.
It's a well-rounded story, and
it is
very, very well rounded.
And of course, talking about that ending piece, you know, without divulging too much, the ending does have a really just... You're looking at this film, and it has a very sciencey perspective. I mean, you could look at it and say, oh yeah, that's really cool that they're using, you know, calculus here and linguistic terminology here. But then when you get to that ending part, it kind of switches gears and becomes a emotional roller coaster, if you will, to allow people to really kind of step back and fully in capture the entire message of the film, which does get a little like overwhelming for me, because now you're realizing, okay, I get it. And you're like, wait, okay, I get it. And it's so much, it's almost like an emotional overload as you're, you know, taking in all this information.
Absolutely. I mean, from a storytelling perspective, the payoff is huge. It's this film accomplishes storytelling on multiple levels, multiple layers simultaneously. It is saying something about us as a people. It is saying something about the present and the future. It's saying something about ultimately a very personal decision.
Yeah.
And the ramifications of that decision. All at the same time, it's accomplishing all of it, not one step at a time, but all at once.
Yeah.
When everything comes together in the end, it's like everything merges, and the personal is the corporate, is the future, is the past, is the, like, it all is one, again, one circular, well-rounded story, and has always been. You know, the story, you know, you may have noticed all these different textures and you know, kind of sidebar moments over the course of the film, but by the time it ends, you realize that those were just, you know, little little grooves and kind of extra bits, you know, around that circle, because you come right back to where you started in a tremendously fulfilling way.
Yeah. So overall, the film is an exceptional experience. I wouldn't even call it a movie, as it's more of a emotional experience that you get to be a part of with other people, you know. So it was a fantastic film. Chad,
yeah,
how many monocles, and does it pass for you?
It definitely passes. Just judging, I mean, sometimes I am just a sucker for something that is really well done, even if it has some things that I'm not a fan of here and there. I would say that this one actually would get 5 monocles for me.
Really?
I would rate it to the top. It's the top of my list for the year so far, because it's, to me, it feels more than a movie. It's extremely rare to have an experience like this one in a movie theater surrounded by dozens of other people. So yeah, 5 out of 5, and definitely a pass for me. How about you?
I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Of course, it's really difficult to find a film that hits those 5 mark, and me, I'm just, yeah, I don't know, I'm just built that way. I guess no film will ever get a 5 out of me, but who knows? But this film is exceptional. It's a film that just exceeds any expectation that I had. I look forward to the new Blade Runner sequel that's going to come out, because I know he's going to take care of this property and he's going to handle it well. I give it a 4.5 out of 5, and it definitely passes for me. But that about wraps up another show for us today. Again, if you have any comments or anything, please drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/philosophers, or our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. It's been a great show, and it was a great conversation. Hopefully we'll see more films like this as Oscar season continues to proceed.
Oh, that'd be a dream.
You know, it'd be wonderful. But before we go, I want to leave you with a little quote. Stanley Kubrick, the famous filmmaker, once said, "A film is, or should be, more like music than fiction. It should be a progression of moods and feelings. The theme, what's behind the emotion, the meaning, all that comes later." So with that, of course, we're going to go ahead and bid you adieu. So my name is Eddie.
I am Chad.
Class dismissed.